What's the question you had when you started the book?
Do I have a family history of illness? And, you know, it was a question that was asked to me repeatedly when I was in the hospital. It was, in the minds of my doctors, the most pressing question that they had. They weren't asking me questions about lifestyle. They weren't asking me questions about symptoms. They were asking me questions about my family. And for me, it was interesting because I'm a historian by training. I teach history, and I could tell you an enormous amount about state building in 17th century Japan or, you know, aspects of world history, but I was unable to tell them anything about my own family. And for that reason, it became a kind of obsession for a couple of years.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Brett Walker about his memoir, A Family History of Illness, Memory as Medicine. Brett pieces together his own family history to the backdrop of medical science, literature, and even existential philosophy. Stay with us. And the book begins in the midst of your own health crisis, where you write, "Thinking about my own death was like swimming in room temperature gravy," which struck me. I've never been in a position to think about my own death in the way that you have, and that image was powerful. For the listeners, can you just describe what happened?
Well, I was traveling over winter break in Minnesota with a friend, and for about the previous 3 years, I'd been having health problems. I'd been getting sick really easy, lots of infections. I would go to the doctor and get prescribed antibiotics. They would work temporarily, but then I would just get sick again. And no one really knew what was going on. When I was traveling in Minnesota, I got the flu. The flu turned into pneumonia. I went to an urgent care. I was given antibiotics for the pneumonia, but they didn't work. And I went back to the urgent care, and the urgent care doctor told me that they won't re-prescribe those drugs, that I needed to go to the emergency room. So when I went to the emergency room and they ran x-rays of my chest, they became pretty alarmed and checked me in. And that's when I started getting barraged with these questions about my family health history. Was I sexually active? Had I had a tattoo recently? Mm-hmm. Anything that might have been exposed me to HIV or any other kind of immune-compromising disease. I think the description of room temperature gravy is, even as my health was getting progressively worse, and maybe part of it had to do with the fact that I was so numbed up in painkillers, I had a very hard time wrapping my mind around the fact that I was going to die. And it was really only after overhearing doctors talking, doctors telling me that it was a good idea to have my family present, doctors beginning to talk to me about sort of end-of-life issues, that I began to realize that I was probably going to die in Minneapolis-St. Paul of some unknown disease that had led to pneumonia. And that's when you begin to think about all of the things that are left undone, all of the relationships that are left unreconciled, all of the things in your life. Oftentimes we don't have time to plan, right? It just kind of sneaks up on you. And it was, for somebody that likes to be in control of things, it was a very hard part for me, yes.
Right, and later in the book you write, "It is disorienting to be a giant compared to your predator and yet completely unable to defend yourself. I've never fully trusted my body again."
Yeah, I haven't. I haven't. And that's been one of the harder things is, you know, the fall comes, the temperatures change. You know, I'm teaching at a university where about every third kid is sniveling and wanting to touch you. And I can't help but think all of the time that, you know, what is going to be the bacterial or viral exchange that's going to compromise my immune system and make me sick again? Because once you remember your body collapsing in the face of an infection, it's very hard to go partially down that path and not think you're going to go all the way down the path, because the feeling is essentially the same. So I haven't been able to trust my body. You know, it's interesting. As somebody who studies the human relationship to the environment and bodily health, I oftentimes think about our relationship to large organisms. One of my books is on the extinction of Japanese wolves, for example, and what it was historically that led to the disappearance of wolves from the Japanese islands. And I've become accustomed to thinking about our relationship to nature through the lens of these larger animals, more charismatic animals. But my confrontation with an immunological disease forced me to confront my relationship to the micro predators in our world, and the ones that you can't see but that are always present.
Right. And the disease itself, you sort of make a joke that it sounds really benign, common variable immunodeficiency.
Yeah, I mean, common, right? I mean, this is the kind of thing that 1 out of 3 Americans carry around or something like that. The fact of the matter is 1 out of about 40 or 50,000 people have it. It's anything but common. And common variable immunodeficiency is characterized by the body's inability to create antibodies. So in a sense, my body is incapable of remembering exposures and identifying exposures to antigens or bad bacteria and viruses and responding to them. So every time I am exposed to a virus or a bacteria, it's as if my body has seen that for the first time. And it has an inability to kind of mount an immunological response. And so my therapy, where I monthly go to the cancer center at Bozeman Health and get an infusion of immunoglobulins, is basically an infusion of other people's antibodies. And so the hypothesis basically is that they will have been exposed approximately to the same viruses and bacteria that I will in that particular season at that particular time, and that their antibodies will work in the absence of my own, and then my body can respond. So I have other aspects of my immune system, I just don't have antibodies.
Mm. So this is where the parallel crosses between science and history, then. You talk about B cells and B cells serving as the body's historians. Can you just explain that to listeners?
Yeah, I mean, so as a historian by training, I am constantly thinking about the role of memory in our life. And this isn't something that was in my mind when I started the book project. This is actually something that I realized over the course of thinking about it. And that is that what the book was really about in the end was the role of memory in our lives, quite literally, you know, our survival. And in a way, the book explores personal memories. So when I was in the hospital bed in Minneapolis, and the doctors were encouraging me to think about a family history of illness, I began to have a flood of these kind of bodily images of my grandfather, of other members of my family, who, as it turns out, had been sick and had suffered from disease and, in fact, died from them. But I hadn't really thought about it in that way ever before. So the book is about remembering and what causes us to remember things in a certain way. There's a lot of the book that deals with neurologists and how they talk about memory, philosophers and how they talk about memory. But then the book also talks about the bodily need to remember. And that's where you get into the B cells and T cells, and how their ability to remember exposures to antigens is what allows us to mount an immunological response to disease. So our lives depend on our body's ability to remember. And then I even extrapolate on that one step further and talk about communities' needs to remember, that this is how we talk about our shared values, this is how we talk about our shared identities, and if we are incapable as communities of remembering as well, that it will have a similar effect on the community as a lack of remembrance might have on the body. That is to say, the body becomes incapable of functioning. And so, in a way, the book is a multi-leveled exploration of the role of memory in our lives.
And one of the questions you ask, and you ask many in the book, do we live in a world where history matters?
Yeah. I believe we do. So right now, I'm teaching a course at Montana State that's titled Making Our World in 10 Events. And basically, the syllabus identifies 10 major things that have happened in the past. and talks about the ways in which they continue to impact young people today. And the course is basically born out of this book project. The course, after I wrote the book, it almost seemed necessary for me to teach a course like this. And basically, what the course tries to do is to teach the students that not all issues or challenges that they face are somehow born in the immediate present. Not everything is a crisis that's born in the immediate present. But in fact, mostly these are things that have metastasized over time. They have roots that exist well before many of these students were born. I mean, you have to imagine that right now we're teaching the first generation of freshmen that were born after September 11th, 2001, right? So in a way, it's easy to forget just how young they are. But there is a sense in the way that we approach education right now, in the way that we talk about our politics, and the way that we view our society that is very presentist, that really doesn't have time for deep reflection about what were the things that occurred in the past that brought us to where we are today, which in my view has undermined our ability to come up with long-lasting viable solutions to some of our biggest challenges. So the course is actually going quite well. I mean, I think that students are beginning to see what it means to think historically, what it means to remember and how important it is. And I think it's my own, you know, in a very small way, attempt to try to challenge this presentist attitude that exists in society today with a more deeply seated historical way of viewing society.
I can't wait to talk about your own personal history and stories. But before we go there, I just want to lay out for listeners that the book, to me, I read it as braided, that there are three main strands. One is the medical historical, which is anchored by scientific research around immunology, and Charles Janeway is kind of the main character. There's this family history and memory piece, which I read as anchored by literature, including Ivan Doig, of course, and Wallace Stegner writing about Montana. And then this existential selfhood, you know, piece, which is anchored by philosophers, specifically Martin Heidegger. Mm-hmm. Does that feel accurate? Portrayal?
Yeah. And I think that follows what we were talking about earlier, the sort of personal memories, you know, the Doig and the Stegner pieces, the bodily memory, which is wrapped up in Janeway's research on immunology, and then the bigger thoughts on history and philosophy, yeah.
Right, so you have this, you raise this notion of existential waypoints. Can you describe that?
Yeah, I mean, when you read good memoir, and, you know, I think Ivan Doig writes good memoir, or Richard Wright, you know, Black Boy is a very, very good memoir. What memoir forces you to do? And incidentally, on this course I'm teaching, that Making Our World in 10 Events, one of the primary assignments is students have to write a history of themselves. And it can't be just a bunch of memoirish mumbo jumbo. It can't be like, you know, my grandfather was this. They actually have to do research on it. They have to have documentation. Because I want them to think about what are some of the events that maybe occurred before they were alive or when they were alive that served as important waypoints for their direction. Admittedly, they're pretty young, so they've been kind of sailing along without many waypoints at this point.
Right.
But, you know, I think that when you read it, when you read memoir, you know, for Ivan Doig, there's the moment when his mother dies, when he's, I think, 6 years old. I can't remember off the top of my head, but they're living in the Bridger Mountains at the time, and he recalls very clearly her last breath. And then that kind of sets he and his father off on this journey together, which consumes the bulk of his memoir. Or Stegner, you know, talking about the sense of Wolf Creek and or Wolf Willow, rather. And I think if you read in Richard Wright's case, it had to do with his mother's growing illness and insanity and mental health problems, and which eventually leads him to leave the South and go to Chicago. But these are powerful points in their life that you learn over the course of reading these memoirs that define almost every decision they make subsequently. So these waypoints tend to make us the people that we are. And they have a resonance that is much deeper than what you might think while it's happening. And that's kind of what I learned about my own family memories, is I hadn't thought about these things for a long time. But as I began to think about, for example, my relationship with my grandfather and his illness, I began to realize that it had shaped so much of my childhood. And I had never really thought about it in that way before. I didn't you know, maybe I just hadn't thought about it, period. But I certainly hadn't thought about it as being a product of my relationship with him. So by waypoint, I mean that these may or may not be things that you intend. These may or may not be things that you even necessarily recognize at the time, but that later on further reflection, you begin to realize that even a moment in time can have a profound impact on shaping the person that you become and the kind of values and decisions that you make later on in your life.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Brett Walker about his book, A Family History of Illness, Memory as Medicine. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Can you tell us one story of an existential waypoint connected to your grandfather?
When I was a young boy, we had a wheat and barley farm in Cascade in the Chestnut Valley. And my mother was born in Great Falls. My father was from Casper, Wyoming, but they both attended Montana State College. And I basically spent my childhood on the farm, mainly in the summers during harvest, because everybody would return to drive combines and grain trucks and what have you in the summer for harvest. But there was also a period that when my father, he was an engineer for Westinghouse in San Francisco, and about mid-career, he decided to change careers, and he wanted to go to law school. And so he was accepted to Lewis and Clark Law School in Portland. And while he was transitioning, my brother and my mother and I lived in Cascade for a full year. So we spent quite a bit of time in my childhood in Cascade. And what I remember from those years is the slow death of my grandfather and how he was a very powerful presence in my family, even though, interestingly, the more I studied my family, the more I would actually describe my family as a matriarchy, not a patriarchy. I mean, what my family was characterized by was very strong women in the household. But he had served in World War II. He was a pilot. He was a contractor, made very nice, high-quality homes in Great Falls. His lifelong dream had been to become a farmer. And I never really fully understood that until I did the research on his family and learned that his father had actually homesteaded in Montana near Choteau, and that after the Dust Bowl, the Montana Dust Bowl of 1920 years, that they had been forced to abandon that land in Choteau, and but that he had always wanted a farm after that. So he bought a little bit of property in Cutbank. He bought a little bit of property near Cascade, then eventually brought the bigger farm in Cascade. And, you know, if you think about his family's experience with the Dust Bowl, it explains why, for example, on buying the land, the first thing he did is put 7 pivot irrigation systems in, which in the end, you know, made the farm viable, but it also meant that he was perennially in debt at the time. But it was immediately after he bought the farm that he was diagnosed with lung cancer. I learned later that he had come from a family of people that had suffered from a variety of different kinds of cancers. And so what I remember in those years is as I, in these very formative years of my life, this kind of melancholy that seemed to be present all the time, particularly with my mom, but also with other members of the family, but him, because I spent a lot of time with him. So I have these very sharp memories of, you know, we had a piece of land that was located on the west side of I-15, basically between Great Falls and Cascade. And I have these very distinct memories of driving around in the pickup truck, him listening to agricultural reports on the radio. And one of the memories I have, I talk about in the book, is he was diabetic, and he'd been given a digital watch, and presumably because of the timing of giving himself an insulin shot, but I don't remember exactly. But he couldn't see the digits because it was those old red digits, right. And it was in the sunlight. And I just remember him looking at me and saying, I just remember this as clear as day. He said something like, what kind of a fool makes a watch you can't see in the daylight, Brett? And I just remember, as clear as day. But then I remember him giving himself an insulin shot, you know, and there was no disposable needles in those days. So he had a little cooler. He had everything with him. But all of a sudden, you know, in the hospital is when these images started to come back to me. I started to remember my family history of illness, not just the family I had remembered before, which was farming and hunting and fishing and all the things you might do growing up as a farm boy in Montana, but I started to remember this health aspect to what was going on in my family as well, and how big a part of growing up that had actually been.
Will you read us a piece relating to your grandfather?
I remember that when I was a young boy, in the early summer of 1976, my family dismantled a Quonset hut in Great Falls, Montana, in order to move it to our wheat and barley farm near Cascade, about 30 minutes south. I was the only grandchild in our family that my grandfather knew well, simply by virtue of my age. I relished working with him. I must have been a complete pest. I wanted to be a farmer so bad it ached. He was my guide. He was my future. I would beg to ride in his pickup truck when we were at the Cascade farm. Like his black lab queen, I watched his every movement around the farmhouse, waiting for some evidence that he was heading out into the fields. Dad, just take him, my mother pleaded. He always kept an old Sears and Roebuck bolt-action .22 in the truck, its barrel pointed towards the floor. He and I shot gophers with it. He complained that they destroyed crops and damaged farm equipment. To me, the reason hardly mattered. Being a little farm boy, I thought shooting at gophers with my grandfather was about as much fun as a human being could possibly have in this world. You know, Dad adored you, my mother once told me. I adored him, too. That summer day when we cleaned the Quonset, my mother told me before I left to help, watch Grandpa. He's not supposed to be smoking. He's very sick from smoking, Brett. At the time, my grandfather was on the early side of his mid-50s. In his youth and up through his time in the Air Force until about 1967, he had been a powerful man. But as he entered his 50s, his health had failed. First, diabetes dogged him, and now lung cancer did. After working for a half hour, packing boxes and moving farm equipment, he would have a smoke, as he always did, while sitting on the tailgate of his truck or leaning against a tractor. He rarely spoke when he smoked. He either looked to the ground, carefully pushing rocks or dirt with the tip of his boot, or looked off into the distance. I knew only this quiet side of him. I remember him sitting at the kitchen table at the Great Falls house, for example, smoking a cigarette, calling a plumber or electrician, and stroking Dusty, his cat, who sprawled on his lap. Even in these trivial acts, he seemed like a Superman to me. The cat, on the other hand, was a vile, hateful creature that tolerated nobody but him. Leroy Bloat, my grandfather, was a quiet man, and he was comfortable in his silence. I suspect he hoped other people were comfortable with it, too. I imagine he felt at home with the man he was. He did not require constant movement and noise, the clumsy impulse to ripple an otherwise clear reflection on water. That kind of clarity can expose aspect of a person's life one would rather not confront. It's like a fly fishing line on the glassy stretch of the Missouri that glides through Cascade, where we fished on warm summer evenings by the sluice gates. An angler needs a ripple to hide his or her leader, otherwise the line becomes visible and scares the fish away. Quiet does this to the monofilament of stories that binds our lives. In the quiet, everything is exposed, for better or worse. My grandfather's words, because they were few, stick with me. I know, I'm not supposed to be smoking. It'll be our secret, Brett. He said as he took a break from dismantling the Quonset hut. He was clearly out of breath. I just stared at him. Within 5 months of this exchange, he was dead.
One of the things you write is, just as frostbitten hands will always be sensitive to the cold, my soul will always be sensitive to Montana. Can you talk about your relationship to Montana?
Yeah. Well, that's part of the, I never fully understood why it was that Montana tugged at me right. in the way that it did. And I grew up in large part in Portland, but continued to rehearse these dreams in my head of being a farmer. I joined Future Farmers of America. For high school project, would raise chickens in my backyard and slaughter them, keeping track of their weights. I mean, we're in just a regular suburban neighborhood. I constantly, in my mind, had this dream of somehow getting back to this farm and becoming a farmer. For some reason, I thought that was my destiny. And I was a poor student in high school. I was kind of a melancholic kid. I wasn't very social. And it was going to a small liberal arts college. I went to the College of Idaho in Caldwell, Idaho, and having an education that turned me on to things that I had never been really exposed to when I'd been in high school, that first enabled me to think about things beyond these memories of growing up on the farm. So I went to graduate school. I graduated from college. I went to graduate school. I ended up living in Japan for quite a while, studied Japanese history. And right after getting my PhD from the University of Oregon, my first job was at Yale University. And I was at Yale University and fairly pleased with myself, as you might imagine, that I'd ended up at such a prestigious college. And I hadn't been there very long, and somebody brought to my attention that there was a job opportunity open at Montana State University in Bozeman in Japanese history. And it was at one of those moments in my life where this flood of memories about Montana mm-hmm. and my connection to the state came roaring back into my life. And to the chagrin of all of my advisors and people around me, I left Yale to begin teaching at Montana State in 1999. So I've almost been there now for 20 years. But Montana does that to me. There's something about, you know, Wallace Stegner talks about this with the smell of wolf willow. There's something about the colors and the smells and the shape of the state.
Yeah.
Particularly in that area around, I was born in Bozeman, but I don't remember Bozeman well. To me, those memories are about Cascade. Those memories are about Great Falls. And it's when I get into that part of the state that it really tugs at me. It evokes something very deep in my childhood, and does that to all my family. My mother's that way. All of us have a very strong connection to Montana.
Brett Walker is Regents Professor of History at Montana State University in Bozeman, Montana. His work spans environmental history, military history, and even Japanese history. Look for more information about his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Bo Baker, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridas.